It was clear you had woke ready to go, and you're like, nah. Yeah.
Woke was ready to go, and then I felt nausea coming up
with
it.
No, we're on
like,
the
don't
precipice
say that.
Of woke, and you just pulled yourself back and redirected.
From Topic Studios and Warner Media Podcast Network, this is Politically Reactive. I'm W. Kamau Bell.
And I'm Hari Kundabolu. Hey, did you know that in Jesus H. Christ, the H stands for Hari Kundabolu?
Once again, we're two friends in stand-up comics and dads trying to make sense of American politics.
Because that's our job on the show. Not because we know that we will make sense of it, because we won't. But we have to, because we're contractually obligated to try.
Hit that subscribe button and give us a good review.
Yeah!
And we love talking to people who can help us understand why American politics is the way it is and what we can do about it.
Adam Gentleson knows one of our most important democratic institutions, the U.S. Senate, from the inside. He worked for Democratic Majority Leader Harry Reid for 6 years.
And now he's out with a new book called Kill Switch, The Rise of the Modern Senate and the Crippling of American Democracy. He digs into the history of the filibuster, and like a lot of things in this country, it goes back to Southern politicians defending slavery and white supremacy. Surprise!
Only civil rights bills were forced to clear this higher threshold. And that is what became the filibuster that we know today.
In this particular case, we can't blame the founding fathers for the filibuster, because they actually wanted a simple majority in the Senate to pass legislation.
That even includes Alexander Hamilton.
In Federalist 22, Alexander Hamilton wrote, "What at first sight might seem a remedy," referring to a supermajority threshold, "is in fact a poison."
One clue that we should get rid of the filibuster is the word filibuster. What kind of fucking Mary Poppins shit is that?
They actually send an email to you saying, "Do you intend a filibuster? Does anybody intend a filibuster?" And all you got to do is reply to that email.
Oh my God.
Yep, just reply. Yep, it's time to cancel the filibuster.
Wait a minute, Kamau. You're not participating in cancel culture, are you?
Yeah, maybe.
Because you know we're going to be talking to Adrienne Marie Brown, whose new book, We Will Not Cancel Us, critiques it.
Be clear, she's not talking about cancel culture the way that Fox News is talking about cancel culture.
What is the impact of having a troll-based administration for 4 years? So it's not like we're outside of that culture of just constant mistruths and throwing accusations and mudslinging.
She's definitely coming at it from the perspective of people inside movements working for liberation.
And she thinks even the most progressive and enlightened of us needs to have space to get things wrong.
Those are the moments when we come the closest to moving towards the society we actually want. When we are able to see like, oh, I just did something so capitalist. I just did something so patriarchal. I just embodied white supremacy. It's like, okay, let's catch that and let's transform that.
Don't worry, Harry. We'll always have plenty of space to get things wrong on this show.
Because we have an editor.
It's all coming up on Politically Reactive. Hey, Harry.
Hey, Kamau. How are you? Did you watch the Super Bowl?
I declined to answer that question out of support for Colin Kaepernick. Did you watch the Super Bowl?
I watched it. I got to be honest with the people. I watched it. I kind of wish I hadn't, honestly. Not only for the Colin Kaepernick thing, but the game wasn't really all that fun. And I don't like Tom Brady. And Tom Brady won again. And I don't like Tom Brady. I don't like his stupid face. I don't like his Trump hat in his locker. You don't forget that he had a MAGA hat.
All right. Well, I mean, the Super Bowl works hard to get black people and people who like black people to watch the Super Bowl. They had Alicia Keys doing Lift Every Voice and Sing. They had Jasmine Sullivan doing the national anthem. They had The Weeknd at the halftime show. So
The Weeknd? Did you know The Weeknd was one guy?
Oh yeah, man! You just culturally aged yourself about 20 years. You didn't know The Weeknd was one guy.
I was like, holy shit! It's one. I thought it was a band.
Oh,
I'm
no.
like, whoa! And then I was hearing the songs. No. I'm like, they did that song. I remember that song from the supermarket. Mm. I remember that song that time I went to the gym. And then I Googled The Weeknd. Mm-hmm. Did you know that he's Ethiopian Canadian? He has two Ethiopian parents, and he speaks Amharic.
I did know he was Canadian because there's a Drake connection between Drake and The Weeknd that has always been. They've beefed occasionally, but yes, I did know he was Canadian. You basically just I want to talk to your dad right now, because maybe if I talk to your dad, you guys switched like personalities or something. So maybe your dad's going to be the guy who's into Weezer now. Maybe there's some sort of like 80s comedy switch that happened over the week, over the weekend. I shot United Shades last week, so I got home on Friday. I was in Dallas, Texas, doing an episode about the transgender community in Dallas, Texas. On my way home, I stopped by Atlanta because CNN has put a mural up, an art mural of my face and all the topics from this season in Atlanta. And so I stopped. I was like, they were like, we're painting this mural for you. And the artist who did it, known as Rising Red Lotus, Brandon Sadler, also painted Shuri's science studio in the Black Panther when Shuri is like in her science element. He did that in the Black Panther. And so I was like, wait, you're doing this. Can I see it? So they said, sure. And so I flew to Atlanta for like 2 hours to go to this unveiling. I mean, I'm making a big deal of it, of this mural. And I put it up on Instagram. And
you did?
Yeah. So it's on the gram and on also Twitter. It's definitely a piece of commerce to promote a TV show. But Brandon Sadler put a lot of effort in. It's beautiful. It's really beautiful. And it was overwhelming. So
God, your ego is going to be out of control.
Well, that was what I said. I said my head on the mural, Melissa says, is actual size. So, like, it's... Me and you have talked about this off the podcast, about the protests in India for Indian farmers. I'm connected to lots of different activists, and I had some activists reach out to me to ask if I would, like, tweet out a link about it, and also that has information, ways to donate, ways to educate yourself, all sorts of things. It's sort of very similar to the Black Lives Matter link that went out at the beginning after George Floyd was murdered, like a sort of a one-stop shop to get educated and also figure out how to help. The link is farmerprotest.carrd.co, farmerprotest.carrd.co, hashtag farmers protest, hashtag stand with farmers. And I sent it out and I got a lot of positive response from the South Asian community just because I was a non-South Asian tweeting about it, you know?
India has... 1.5 billion plus people. So like this, you know, farmers make up a large percentage of that. And they're getting screwed over right now because there were farm bills passed without debate in the Indian legislative houses. They went right through. It's the right wing BJP government that's in charge. And it's basically pro-capitalist legislation that makes it easier for farmers to sell their produce, to sell whatever it is they're growing across state borders, right? Which in theory sounds good. Okay, that means if I can't sell it in this market, I'll sell in this market. But the thing is, you know, if you're growing apples and you need to transport it to another state, you're going to probably need like a refrigerator or some kind of unit. You're going to need a truck. And you know what? Poor farmers that have less than 3 acres of land probably can't afford that. Mm. They can only sell their products where they are. Meanwhile, you know, agribusiness, big corporations, they can basically lower the cost everywhere, lower the prices everywhere. Mm-hmm. And it's unfair. And it's under the guise that it's helping farmers, and it is not. And I think the fact that so many people are marching, are leaving work, are to support the farmers all around. And India is a country with many different languages, right? Each state has its own thing. Each state's basically its own country. And you go to New Delhi and people are protesting from all across the country, farmers from all across the country. Certainly a lot of the folks are Punjabi farmers, led the way, but like it is a national movement. We're talking about global workers' rights and we're talking about this privatization that's happened all over the world. We talk about it in this country. It's happening all over the world, and it's destroying the lives of so many people in India.
And I think the thing to really highlight is that all the themes that we've talked about in this country over the last year, police brutality, nationalism, government propaganda, are also the themes in this protest.
Yes.
America, we like to focus on ourselves. We like to really stay away from world events and world news unless it's about us going over there to interrupt them. But these issues are our issues.
Especially, you know, India, large percentage of the world population.
Yes.
So, you know, this is a huge story. Also, I think, again, it's really cool to the folks that send this information to Kamau. I think that's great. Let me just say, where is mine? I don't want to make this about me. This is about the farmers. But brothers and sisters, hey. It's me.
Thing I noticed when I tweeted out this link to all this information and all the and to the farmers' protest is that I got a lot of credit for being an outsider to the community who was supporting this community. And you know, there's we're like in the history of the world, we're one of the top 10 Black South Asian alliances. Like we're like already in the history of mankind.
I would say top three.
Okay,
honestly, top four.
And that's what I think is important. People who are listening to this who are not South Asian, who don't know anything about this. That if you go out there and sound the alarm, people are going to listen to you more because you're sort of like not, quote unquote, in your lane, which this is a time to not stay in your lane. So I think it's, but yes, also they should send it to you too.
I was doing the math. We are number three. It would be, if I remember, it would be Kamala Harris's parents. That would be one. then it would be Denzel Washington and Sarita Chowdhury Mississippi Masala. Yeah. And then it'd be us.
That's funny. So one of those relationships is fictional.
Correct.
And it's still, but Denzel Washington, that is definitely, I'm forever outranked by Denzel Washington on the Black side. So yes, that's how that works.
But again, if you do want to reach out to me, you should know I don't just kill cartoon characters. I do have other political interests.
I think it was on Saturday morning I saw a post on Questlove's Instagram from an activist named Amanda Nguyen, who was talking about the hate crimes against Asian Americans that have happened in the Bay Area, but also around the country. And I'd already read about them on Daniel Wu, who's a great actor, martial arts star. He basically is everything I want to be. I wanted to be when I was a kid. I was like, I'm going to be Bruce Lee. He's done way more of that than me. And he had sort of started Instagramming about it, like saying, like, I don't like to post basically videos of Asian Americans getting beat up or getting attacked, but I just feel like I don't know what else to do. So out of that, just in the last couple of days, there's come a lot of energy of Asian Americans coming together to figure out how to address these issues. And part of that is like, they know they have their own in-house business to take care of. So as far as like how Asian Americans, older Asian Americans often don't report hate crimes. And also older Asian Americans aren't necessarily cool with their Asian American kids hanging out with the Black Lives Matter folks. So there's a lot of internal business to do. But the bigger part of this is that those of us outside of the community, those of us on the outside, whether or not we feel like we're being supported by that community regularly or not, need to stand up for what is right. And so Amanda Nguyen, over the course of a couple days, that clip that was posted on Questlove's, it sort of went around and went viral. And by Sunday, they were on Alicia Mendez's show on MSNBC. And Amanda had a great thought about how we should go forward in this moment.
We're in a moment of reckoning, and we get to decide what kind of country we are, what kind of people we are. You know, I urge people to wake up and choose love.
And it's a good thing to talk about, because as we're trying to figure out what we're doing at this moment with everything going on, we have a person on the show who is about facilitating conversation and dealing with people in moments of conflict. It is the author and pleasure activist, Adrian Marie Brown, and she's going to come on to talk about her new book, We Will Not Cancel Us and Other Dreams of Transformative Justice.
I've wanted to talk about the India farmer thing for a little while, but I keep getting nervous. I'll say the wrong thing, and people are going to get angry, and they're going to be angry on the internet, and I'm going to get canceled, and like, I think that kind of prevented me from wanting to push it earlier because I'm like, I don't want to screw this up. And I think a lot of what this conversation's about is how that hurts us as organizers and activists, and that kind of fear of cancellation and the fear of saying the wrong thing or making a mistake and not being allowed to grow leads up to a certain kind of stasis.
And before we get to Adrian Marie Brown, we have another conversation. We're going to talk to Adam Gentleson about how the Senate became the place where legislation went to die and how we can change that and how it's not even that hard to change it. We just got to, come on, Democrats, just change it.
Adam Gentleson is Public Affairs Director at Democracy Forward, which exposes and challenges corruption in the executive branch.
He spent 6 years working for Senator Harry Reid as Communications Director and then Deputy Chief of Staff when Reid was Senate Majority Leader.
That experience taught him how dysfunctional the Senate is, and his new book, Killswitch, tells the story of how it got that way and why it needs to change.
Let's talk to Adam. Oh, Adam. Adam, welcome to Politically Reactive. We're happy to have you.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
One of the things we do on our show is try to understand things that seem to be not understandable. And so we appreciate people like you who make a career on helping people understand things that seem to be not understandable in politics.
Happy to give it a try. The Senate is the place to go, man.
Yeah, exactly. And they seem to work hard to make things less understandable. Am I right on that?
Absolutely. The Senate likes to wrap itself in its own myths because those myths are very self-serving. And it doesn't want to be understood. And I think, you know, part of what I try to do here is help people understand what this institution is, how it got to be the way it is, how structural racism deeply shapes everything about the way it is today, and try to do it in a clear way that I hope is somewhat understandable. But I'm, you know, happy to be here today to talk to you guys too.
So my first question is one word: filibuster.
So yes. Like,
and embedded in that is what, when, how, why, to what extent? Like it's something. It's a word that I heard growing up that was just like, I guess that's just a part of government. And then the more you hear it, and the more like, wait, I think this doesn't have to be here.
And that's right. I mean, it was not there in the beginning. And I think that's something that's really important for your listeners to understand, which is that, you know, it's something we've all come to regard as a sort of foundational part of government, but it wasn't supposed to be there. And, you know, look, I'm not an originalist, but I do think that this conversation about the filibuster and about the Senate in general often revolves around tradition and the framers' intent. So it's important to go back and ground us in that history. And that history is an open and shut case. The filibuster wasn't a part of the original Senate. And not only was it not included in the original Senate, the original Senate had lots of rules that would allow senators at the time to end debate when it got too long and obstructive. And there was a clear reason for this, which is that the framers had just had direct firsthand experience with what happens when you let an obstructionist minority block things. Under the Articles of Confederation, sort of the first draft of American government, it took a supermajority to pass things in the Congress, so, you know, two-thirds. When they created the Constitution, the framers were extremely clear that they thought that had been a disaster, and that when you let a minority, a numerical minority in Congress, block anything from passing that they unite against, it creates an irresistible incentive for obstruction. And so they were very, very clear in the Federalist Papers, in Madison's letters, in many, many writings, that they didn't want to allow an obstructionist minority to block what the majority wanted to do. So the filibuster didn't exist, so they couldn't have opposed it because it didn't exist at the time. But they were very clear that if anybody tried to invent anything like it, they would have opposed it. And then what happened was, through a series of rules changes over the early 19th century, some of the rules allowing people to end debate fell away. This was because it wasn't a problem at the time. Obstruction wasn't an issue. And then a certain numerical minority found itself with a very compelling desire to increase its power over the majority. And that minority was the slave power and slaveholders in the South, led by John Calhoun, who is a senator from South Carolina, sort of spiritual father of the Confederacy. And he wanted to increase the power of the minority, the minority that he represented, to block the majority, because he saw that if the majority had its way, slavery was going to be abolished. And so he invented what we would now sort of identify as the talking filibuster as a way to increase the power of the numerical minority to block what the majority wanted to do. So it was that desire to sort of find a way for the slave power, once it was outnumbered, to increase its power and block what the majority wanted to do, that led to the creation of what we would identify as the talking filibuster in the first place.
First of all, just for our listeners.
All right, technically, I already did first of all. I just think I would like to.
Second of all.
Thank you.
I think it would be useful for our listeners and us to get a reminder of what the filibuster is and what does it do and what the function is. Why do people do this?
Let me explain it two different ways, because there's what it was and there's what it is today. What it used to be was a long speech, basically. Someone standing on the floor, people think maybe of Jimmy Stewart and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, you know, talking for as long as they can until they collapse in order to block some bill that they oppose. That was sort of what John Calhoun invented, and that's sort of the way the filibuster was through the 19th century into the 20th century.
What do you mean by block? You mean like, so people are like, we need to move on to the next thing. We're not going to vote on this. We're just going to
Like,
yeah, as long as it, back in the day, as long as someone was standing on the floor, you couldn't conduct any other business. So as long as they were physically holding the floor, giving a speech, you couldn't pass anything. You couldn't move on to any other business. And they could sort of, you know, coordinate with their allies to pass the baton back and forth and keep going. But no business could get done as long as they were blocking it. But the thing about it was that eventually they had to stop talking at some point, and then you can move on with the business. So it was able to delay and sort of block for a short period of time a bill or other business, but it couldn't stop it altogether. And that's the crucial turn that happened in the 20th century, was that because of some rules changes in the Senate, people started to be able to apply this new higher vote threshold. For the first 200 years of its existence, the Senate was everything passed or failed on a simple majority. You know, a bill came to the floor, they debated it for a while, then there was a vote, simple majority, up or down, pass or fail. But in 1917, a new rule was introduced that created a supermajority threshold. At the time, it was 2/3 of the Senate as opposed to a majority. Now it's 3/5, so that's why it's the 60 votes that we think of today. This was the Jim Crow era, of course, and at this time, Southern senators faced the same problem that John Calhoun faced in his day, which is that left to its own devices, the majority was going to start passing civil rights bills. Even in the 1920s, there were anti-lynching laws, anti-poll tax laws that started to pass the House of Representatives by big margins, come over to the Senate, where they seemed to have majority support, and they had presidents of both parties, the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue, ready to sign them. So the Southern senators, once again, needed to find a way to increase the power of their minority faction to stop action. And delaying wasn't enough at this time. They could talk and talk and talk, but these bills had majority support and they were going to pass, so that when they stopped talking, these bills were going to pass. So they used this new rule to start to require civil rights bills and only civil rights bills to meet a higher threshold for passage. Wow. Of 2/3 of the Senate. Every other bill during the Jim Crow era that came before the Senate either passed or failed on the basis of whether it could get a majority vote. Only civil rights bills were forced to clear this higher threshold. And that is what became the filibuster that we know today. Now we've taken the threshold that we used to apply only to civil rights bills, and we're applying it to everything. And so the filibuster today doesn't have any actual debate. It's just the application of this higher threshold to every bill on every issue under the sun. And that's why the government can't get anything done.
Wait, you don't need to give a speech anymore?
You do not need to give a speech anymore.
Wait, then what the hell was Ted Cruz doing? Ted Cruz, remember, he was reading Dr. Seuss and he was staying up all night.
Could you, would you, with a goat? I would not, could not, with a goat.
He was just doing that to be an asshole then.
Exactly.
There was no Wow!
Yeah.
What? Are you surprised that Ted Cruz was doing something to be an asshole, Hurry? Is that
I just the idea that it had no practical purpose. There was no reason to do that.
That's again, right. On brand for Ted Cruz, I think No Practical Purpose is the name of his memoirs.
Yeah, that's right. No, I was in the Senate that day waiting out that filibuster, that fake filibuster, and having fun trying to explain to reporters why it was really a fake filibuster. But no, that's right. I mean, there's no debate today. There's no need to debate. You simply send an email to your leaders and you say, I intend to filibuster. And just that email alone takes that majority vote that the bill was supposed to have and raises it to 60 votes. And then it stays there and you don't have to give a speech. And that's why it's so hard to pass everything in the Senate. I mean, that's it.
When you think about all the revolutionary change that happened in this country with like Paul Revere and the Boston Tea Party and how people have to physically put themselves in the American Revolution, just telling your intern, could you send an email and put subject line filibuster? Thanks. Done for the day.
They actually send an email to you saying, do you intend to filibuster? Does anybody intend to filibuster? And all you got to do is reply to that email.
Oh, my God.
Yep. Just reply, yep.
I'm not joking. I mean, it sounds hilarious and it sounds sad, but this is actually how it works.
Wait, so to vote, they won't let us do anything electronically. Everything is done as old school as possible. But in order to prevent stuff from getting done while you're in Congress, you just have to say yes or no.
That's right.
Okay.
So, I mean, to me, this feels like it's all in line with the same thing that brought the same sort of thinking behind government that brought us the Electoral College. And you connected it to the slave states already. So that's the same thing that the Electoral College comes from. This idea of like, what happens if a majority of people is white men with money how do we make sure that they get to be treated as a majority?
But what's particularly nefarious about the filibuster is that even in the early 20th century, you had a majorities of white men who were ready to start doing at least some very rudimentary things on civil rights. You know, we're taught that the Senate forces this delay that is supposed to contain wisdom, and, you know, that the country wasn't ready for civil rights before 1964. Now, I'm not saying that the country wasn't very, very racist back then, but on things like lynching and poll taxes, the record is very clear that bills to start implementing federal enforcement against lynching and federal enforcement against poll taxes in the South, there was clear support for those bills as early as 1891. And definitely in the 1920s when these bills started passing the House. I mean, they were getting majority support in the House, they had majority support in the Senate, and they had presidents on the record ready to sign them. When Gallup polled anti-lynching laws in 1937, it found 72% of the American public in favor of federal anti-lynching laws. When it polled anti-poll tax laws in 1940s, it found upwards of 60% of Americans in support of those laws. It even found majority support in the South. So, you know, this wasn't exactly an enlightened country, but they were at least ready to start doing some basic things. And the Senate and its filibuster is the only reason that there weren't federal anti-lynching laws passed as early as 1891 and definitely starting in the 1920s, or anti-poll tax laws as early as 1891.
I think I know the answer to the question I'm about to ask you, but does any other country do this?
No.
Okay.
No, the answer is no. We are the weirdos when it comes to this. Every other country has majority rule legislatures, every other modern democracy, and even some of the oldest and most stable ones. Every state legislature has majority rule. I mean, Robert's Rules of Order, the sort of foundation of every, you know, most parliamentary procedure, is majority rule straight through. And that's the way ours was supposed to be. You know, they enumerated specific uses for supermajority thresholds in the Constitution. That's why removal from office requires a supermajority threshold, amendments to the Constitution, treaties. But everything else was supposed to be a simple majority because that was the way it was supposed to be.
So there's been talk of getting rid of the filibuster, and you would think that Democrats who have dealt with the Republican Party, especially over the last 4 years, would be excited to get rid of the filibuster. But there seems to be some Democrats who are not excited about getting rid of the filibuster. Joe Manchin, Kyrsten Sinema. And to me, it feels like this to me is where the awful part of politics. It feels like to me, especially Joe Manchin, I feel like I'm pretty important now. I should probably take some unpopular stances just so I can get taken out to better dinners, even though it seems like it would be in the best interest of the party to get rid of the filibuster.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think that part of this is a power play and a leverage play. I would say, you know, particularly look at someone like Senator Sinema, who has never sort of staked out any reputation as a Senate institutionalist before. It's a little surprising coming from her. But in some ways that is also your opportunity for moving them to a pro-reform position, because I think that what's going to happen here is, I mean, right now they think they're standing in the way of like Medicare for all, right? And sort of left policies. But I think what's going to become clear is that by supporting the filibuster, it's not Medicare for all that's getting blocked. It's like the entire Biden agenda and everything that can't get through reconciliation, which is a separate issue. But just for the sake of this conversation, that means most things. Most things are going to get blocked by the filibuster. And so when it becomes clear that Sinema and Manchin are blocking Biden's agenda, that's when the rubber meets the road. And I think this conversation gets real and you start talking about where are ways you can compromise? What are some types of reform that you might be open to? Because the success of the Biden administration and the success of every Democrat that's running in 2022 and the Democrats' attempt to hold their majorities in the House and Senate is going to ride on their ability to get big things done. And I think at the end of the day, when it comes down to that, and it's not going to take very long, I think that's going to become evident in the next few months. When it gets down to that, I think that's where the conversation with Manchin and Sinema starts to get, okay, you said you don't want to abolish the filibuster. What does reform look like? What does changing the filibuster look like? What are some other ways we can try to find a way to get to yes here?
What is their logic for not abolishing it? Do they have logic, or is it just like their constituents are very moderate?
They argue that they want to see bipartisanship and that, the you know, by its very nature, by imposing a 60-vote threshold, the filibuster requires bipartisanship because you've only got 50 Democrats. So to get to 60, you need 10 Republicans. You know, that's an interesting thing because that is one thing that the framers nailed. They knew that people were going to argue that it requires, that the filibuster facilitates bipartisanship. And they were very clear that that's not what happens in practice. In Federalist 22, Alexander Hamilton wrote, "What at first sight might seem a remedy," referring to a supermajority threshold, "is in fact a poison because it doesn't do it." And that was the quote. Now I'm saying in my own words, it doesn't do what you think it's going to do. It doesn't help you get bipartisanship. It doesn't cause the other side to come around and cooperate. It allows the other side to block you, in his words, to embarrass the administration and the good functioning of government. So they called it, and that's what we're seeing today. So I think the bipartisanship argument is, it's, you know, in a month from now when nothing's getting done, that argument is going to seem very silly.
When I vote for a candidate, I don't think, wow, I hope they can work well with the Republicans. I want things done. I want things to actually be accomplished and my values to somewhat be reflected. So I that's not a question. I'm just angry right now.
No, but I think bipartisanship, you know, we used to live in an era where it was natural because you had liberals and conservatives in both parties. So bipartisanship just sort of flowed naturally because you had you know, Republican senators like Jacob Javits, the liberal of New York, who were, and Edward Brooke from Massachusetts. These were Republicans. And you had super conservative Democrats like segregationist James Eastland, Strom Thurmond, these folks who, you know, were deep segregationists in the Democratic Party. So, you know, you had bipartisanship because liberal Democrats would join with liberal Republicans to get things done, or conservative Democrats would join with conservative Republicans to get things done. So it was more about people of the same ideology coming together across party lines. Today, everybody's sorted into the same party. So all, you know, liberals are Democrats and all conservatives are Republicans. That's a relatively new thing. It's only the last few decades that's been true. But bipartisanship, it often becomes a vanity thing. I mean, it's more about senators wanting to sort of get the praises of the Beltway punditocracy, I think, than it is about getting things done. But I think that's the thing, is right now they're going to face a choice very soon where it's like, look, you could chase bipartisanship for the rest of the year and deliver nothing, or you can deliver results. And I think there's been some encouraging rhetoric from the Biden administration that they really do see their primary purpose here. You know, bipartisanship is great if it's forthcoming, but their primary purpose is to deliver results. And if that can't be done in a bipartisan way, they're going to try to move forward with Democrats alone.
I have to say, I really appreciated that meeting the other day after those 10 GOP senators came in to talk to him. And out of that there, he was like, "Nice to see you. It was great to sit down." Anyway,
I mean, that's the best. If Biden could do that, he can regale them with stories for 2 hours. You know, they can have a great meeting and then he can be like, "Great, well, I'm going ahead myself."
They were like, "Man, I didn't know Corn Pop had such an interesting life, but we didn't get anything we wanted." So in regards to that, we're about to have a bunch of stuff going on this week that has nothing to do with getting anything done as far as policy goes. We're talking about the impeachment trial of one Donald John Trump. Bipartisanship on that does not seem likely. It does not seem likely that we get 17 senators to flip on Trump, to turn state's evidence against Trump, since they wouldn't turn state's evidence against Marjorie Taylor Greene. But they were quite angry at Liz Cheney. Knowing that, I sort of feel like history will look at us better if we have at least tried. Like, you know, I get that some people see it as a waste of time, but I feel like history sometimes grades on effort, you know? And to me, just sort of not doing it all seems like just sort of throwing up your hands. But I know a lot of people say it's just a waste of time. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that it's important to establish a historical record here. I mean, you have to show that there was an attempt to hold him accountable. And you have to show that, you know, a majority of the Senate did want to hold him accountable. Because that's, you know, even if we lose the vote, even if Democrats lose the vote, you know, there's going to be a majority in favor of conviction. Then I think it's also important to show that Republicans voted to let this guy off the hook. That's a vote that I think will hurt them. And that's a vote they're going to have to live with for the rest of their careers and explain to their kids and grandkids. So it won't be as satisfying as actually convicting the guy. But I do think that's critically important. If you don't do it, what does it say? I mean, it says that we didn't bother, that we didn't want to use the tools at our disposal to hold him accountable. I think that you can't just let it go. You have to try. And if it doesn't succeed, you have to show who's responsible for it not succeeding.
Last week, Schumer and McConnell came to a power sharing agreement. What does that mean? And is that just a thing, you know, every session there's a discussion of like, we'll be fair to each other this time, or like, what is it?
I think power sharing is a bit of an overstatement because Democrats aren't really giving much power to Republicans. The one major concession is that there will be equal numbers of Democrats and Republicans on the committees, but Democrats still control the committees. And that's the control is the really important thing. It allows you to set the agenda. You control more staff. And then as part of the agreement, they agreed that if there's a tie vote, it's as if the Democrats had won, the whatever is in contention can go onto the floor. So there's a little bit of a concession there. That's sort of an acknowledgement of this split Senate, but mostly, you know, the day-to-day functioning of the Senate will be as if Democrats were in the majority.
How much of the issue with this is that when there are these sort of power-sharing agreements, or when there's talk of the filibuster, that when Republicans are in power, they just sort of ignore all of it and just do whatever they can to get things through, like that, you know, and that Democrats are often like, man, if only the rules were different. Oh, gosh, dang it, that we exist in a situation where Republicans always drive it like they stole it, and Democrats tend to drive it like they rented it and forgot to get the insurance. So that, like, if Democrats did it the way Republicans do it, we wouldn't have to worry about all this, all the parliamentary agreements.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I think that, you know, a lot of this hemming and hawing over whether to get rid of the filibuster and just pass things themselves that you're seeing from Democrats, I don't think you would have seen that from Republicans. I mean, you saw some of that from like Bob Corker and Jeff Flake, but then Mitch McConnell just sort of moved forward with what he wanted to do. And then Bob Corker and Jeff Flake came along in the end. I think that, you know, Republicans would be going nuclear. They would be ramming this through. I think that's actually an important lesson for those who are somewhat hesitant about getting rid of the filibuster, which is that, you know, Democrats have 2 years here to get stuff done. And given, you know, you see Republicans already going hard at voter suppression in the states, in Arizona and Georgia, you know, and if we don't do things, not just passing economic policies and climate change and all that stuff that is very important, but if we don't pass democracy reforms and we don't pass a John Lewis Voter Rights Act, and we don't pass things like DC statehood that are going to sort of try to tilt the balance of these structures that are right now dramatically tilted towards Republicans back towards a level playing field, who knows when we're going to get power again? It might be a long time. It might be never. So, you know, Democrats need to, you know, take a page from Republicans a little bit here. They have power. Senate rules have been changed many times throughout its history, as I lay out in the book. They're entirely within their rights to do so. The procedure that would be used to change the rules in this instance has been used 18 times in recent decades. If they want to do it, they can do it, and I think that they should.
I don't know if you have an answer to this, but why are they like this, Adam? Why? Are they just too old? Like, what? Why?
Man, I wish I had an answer to that. I wonder that myself. I think that, you know, I've never watched The West Wing, but I feel like it's bad for our political culture. I'm sorry to any West Wing fans out there. But the reason I say that half in jest, but also kind of seriously. And the reason I say it is that I think that there's this... It's like the movie Dave, where they sort of all come together. There's this glorification of process in that, in those sorts of portrayals, where the nobility of sort of coming together, it's what we were talking about bipartisanship before, where, you know, that is sort of held up as the greater good, where, you know, people are out in the world suffering and we need to get things done. And the focus shifts from the people who are suffering, who need help, to sort of, are politicians gonna, you know, show and set an example and come together across party lines? It's like, man, that would be great, but let's focus on delivering help to the people who need it, and actually getting things done. And I'm not going to say that the West Wing is responsible for all of our ills, but I feel like it sort of exemplifies a little bit of it. For whatever reason, liberals and many Democrats tend to care more about that sort of good government process stuff when they really should be focused on delivering results for the people who are suffering really bad right now and who really need help.
I think you're right. I think the West Wing was trying to say, this is how it should be done, or we wish it was done, but without creating the impression that, like, it can't be done this way, because sort of every episode of the West Wing ends up with the conservative politician going, you know, Rut, you're right.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. And so what do you do? And the reality of our politics right now, you need to face it front on, which is that Republicans have massive structural incentives to obstruct, and they're not going to change. It is the politically rational thing for them to do to obstruct Democrats, because if they throw a monkey wrench, I'm not saying it's right, but it is the correct sort of political gamesmanship choice to obstruct Democrats so that they don't get anything done. And Republicans are one seat away from taking back the Senate majority in the next elections and only a few seats away from taking back the House majority, so that if they use obstruction to make Democrats look bad and, you know, voters are frustrated and dissatisfied because if there's ongoing gridlock in Washington and Democrats aren't delivering the results they promised, they're going to vote for Republicans in the election, and Republicans are going to take back their majority. So it's right for them to obstruct. Democrats need to confront that and know that they're not going to be convinced. They're not going to pull a West Wing and realize that the rationality of our arguments are overwhelming and come around to our side of things. We just need to get things done.
Thank you, Adam, for coming on the podcast. We really appreciate it.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me. This was great. Thank you very much.
Adam Gentleson is Public Affairs Director at Democracy Forward. He also spent 6 years working for Harry Reid when he was Senate Majority Leader.
Adam's new book is Kill Switch: The Rise of the Modern Senate and the Crippling of American Democracy.
Adrienne Marie Brown is an author, women's rights advocate, social justice facilitator, and pleasure activist.
Her books include Emergent Strategy and the New York Times bestseller Pleasure Activism: The Politics of Feeling Good.
She's out with a new book, We Will Not Cancel Us, and Other Dreams of Transformative Justice.
This is one of my favorite conversations of the season. I can't wait for y'all to hear it. So let's get Adrienne in here. Adrienne Marie Brown, thank you so much for joining us on Politically Reactive. We're both fans and really appreciate you being here.
I'm super geeked. I've been a fan of y'all's for a while, so I'm happy to be here and get into it with you.
That takes a lot of the pressure off for me because Jocelyn is such a big fan of my partner is such a big fan of yours, and I really can't screw this interview up. So the fan that you like our work kind of makes me
feel
a little
more. It's all balancing out. Tell her that even if you do mess up, I'll still make it look good. But we won't lead to any bad things. So.
It's the footprints in the sand. That's when Adrienne Marie Brown was carrying
That's
you.
That's when I was carrying you. With mittens on.
I mean, the first thing, you know, I'd love to talk about is the subject of your new book. You know, cancel culture obviously is something that a billion think pieces have been written about. It's basically the new politically correct or identity politics or another phrase that is vague, but everyone seems to have very strong opinions on one way or the other. Do you have a working definition of cancel culture that we can use at least to have a discussion? Because I often feel like
it
means a million different things to different people. And certainly the way right-wing media posits it is very different than a lot of us who are in activist circles talk about it. So I'd love to hear what your opinion of it is.
I think of culture all the time as what we are co-creating, what we are immersed in and co-creating, right? So it's like the way we are with each other. And we're in it, we're part of it, we could be impacted in. So to me, the cancel culture, or what I've seen emerging, is this being immersed in a situation that we can constantly feel we can dispose people from, right? And that disposing of them will somehow make our culture more like solid and safer and better and more aligned with our values if we just get this person out. Like the actual act of cancellation, I think, started for good reason, right? It was like, there's a massive power imbalance, and we as brown and black and indigenous people and women and trans people, we are going to break the boundary, the huge boundary between us and someone who has much more power over us by calling for the cancellation, the attention that a cancellation brings. But now once it becomes culture, it's just this kind of ubiquitous activity that almost anyone's name you mention now, they're like, well, you know. And then it's like, well, I don't actually know. What have they done, and have they done anything to rectify that, and what are the power dynamics of the situation, what could they do? And you'll see in the way that I approach it is I come from an abolitionist standpoint. So it's like, if you're not an abolitionist and you're just out here like, I hate this person, they're transphobic, whatever, that's one thing. But for those of us who are like, we're trying to lead people towards defunding the police and ending the prison system and like really have an abolitionist vision for the future, my question is, where does this practice of disposability fit into that vision? And I think we have to reckon with it.
I was listening to an Instagram sermon from Janae of the Future.
Future.
Yes. And
they were drawing a distinction between call-out culture and cancel culture. Yes. And with call-out culture predating it, the idea is of like in within community, you're calling out a peer, a member of your group, and it can be done well, it can be done poorly. Yeah. It also gets complicated, they say, because of the seeking of capital within community circles. Well, I'm the person who calls people out, and that puts I'm therefore more, you know, like thoughtful. I was going to say woke, but then I changed my mind.
It was clear. I felt ready to go, and you're like, yeah. Nah.
Woke was ready to go, and then I felt nausea coming up.
No,
with
we're
it.
On
like,
the
don't
precipice of woke, and you just pulled yourself back and redirected.
Yes,
good.
With cancel culture, yeah. It seems like because you talk about the idea of, you know, when there's a power difference, but you also talk about the idea of horizontal
yes.
relationships when power dynamics they aren't so different.
Yeah.
So in that situation, how does that function? One, do you see that?
Yeah,
distinction?
I definitely
do you also
think
see
there's
distinction
that in? Distinction. I think there's the distinction of like calling out versus calling in, which a lot is yeah. mostly tone, right? It's like mm-hmm. you fucked up. Or I see that you made a mistake, right? Like it's energetic. I also think there's, to me, that difference of that person is canceled is we're not actually trying to engage with them anymore. The thing for me that I'm most curious about is those places where it is a peer-to-peer relationship or we're in movement where the power dynamic shifts can often be very subtle. Like they might feel very intense to someone who's like right up close to them. But when you step back, it's like, we're all broke people trying to create change and mm-hmm. movement. And like maybe some of us have a little bit more of a following than others or whatever. But in general, we're not celebrities. We're like coworkers, co-collaborators. In those situations, I'm like, why are we treating those, you know, people who might be causing harm or speaking out of alignment with what we know to be the way we want to talk to each other and about each other? Why are we treating those people the same way we might treat a Bill Cosby or an R. Kelly or someone way beyond our reach and an egregious sexual harm person? You know, like I think we can cultivate in ourselves the capacity to make those distinctions. And then even for those people who have caused the most harm, I think our vision has to hold that there's something other than prison and disposal that is possible there. But especially with our own people that we're in relationship with, it's not easy work at all. But, you know, because it's so much easier when someone pisses you off to just be like, and scene. I'm never mm-hmm. spending any yeah, more time yeah. on you. Like, mm-hmm. you're annoying. And especially if someone's caused, you know, we have people in our movement community who are sexual predators. We have, like, everything that's happening in the larger world is happening in the microcosm of movement or the microcosm of the arts or the microcosm of any other realm. It's what do we want to do about it as people with analysis that says something else is possible. And I don't know if y'all know this, but I wrote a blog post that got a bunch of like special feelings yeah. back. And then a lot of special feelings, right?
Yes.
Some of them were really positive and some of them were like, you know, you're canceled, yeah. right? Like I get the full range.
You cancel
things.
Us, we cancel you, cancel
exactly, yeah, yeah, right? Yeah. It really became, and I was like, let me sit and figure this out. And I was like, oh, here's some distinctions that I was not clear enough about in the original piece that I want to be much more clear about in the book. But I was like, this is just the tip of the iceberg of distinctions that we should be making. It is different to misgender someone than it is to physically attack someone. It's different. Mm-hmm. How do we hold those differences in our community? It is different to do stuff repeatedly than to do something one time. How do we hold those distinctions? And then one of the things in a call out scenario, often we are saying, we're calling you out and here's some things that you could do. In the cancellation scenario, there's nothing else you can do, Kanye. It doesn't matter. It's done. Whatever, you know?
That's funny because my next question was going to be a two-word question that was going to be simply Kanye West.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, I think Kanye is actually a fascinating, I think we have these interesting characters because part of what we're always talking about is mental health and what do we do with people who are struggling with their mental health publicly? Do they get called out? Do they get canceled? You know, do we say you're not well, so we're going to give you a pass on your public behavior? Or do we say, it doesn't matter, you've been unwell publicly for so long, you're now causing a whole different kind of harm? You know, it's one thing with someone like a Kanye who we're not in that direct relationship with, but in our communities that happens all the time. Not like movements are known for their excellent healthcare or having, like, you know, tons of budget for people who are struggling with their mental well-being. I really think about that, that I'm like, we're swimming in a culture that is not well, and a lot of our people are not well, and that shows up by us doing the same things that we're trying to end in the world. How do we handle it when that happens? And I think that those moments, those are the moments when we come the closest to moving towards the society we actually want. When we are able to see, like, oh, I just did something so capitalist. I just did something so patriarchal. I just embodied white supremacy. It's like, okay, let's catch that and let's transform that. Mm-hmm. And instead we're saying, let's catch that and let's erase that. Let's push that away from us.
The quote that my best friend Jason told me years ago, I'm reminded of, if you maintain your head while all around you have lost theirs, you've clearly misunderstood the problem. So yes. That's the same.
Yes. Yeah.
That's
and
the
you
same.
Know,
I don't know. That's what
it feels like that, right? It feels like that. And especially these last 4 years, I think part of why I was moved to write in this moment was it's like, okay, you know, I was coming out of 6 months away. I had been on a sabbatical, pandemic, everything was wild. But I'm also like, what is the impact of having a troll-based administration for 4 years? Mm. So it's not like we're outside of that culture of just constant mistruths and throwing accusations and mudslinging and then the trolling each other and that way of engaging, like social media way of engaging, it's kind of swept the world. You know, for us in movement, we're not outside of that. I see so many people who, when I interact with them face to face, they're like, love and peace and light and justice and liberation. And like, we got to be here for each other. We got to have each other's backs. And then like an hour later, I'll go online and they're on Twitter like, you know, fuck that asshole, like da 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 da. And I'm just like, right. Wait.
Fire emoji, pitchfork emoji.
Yes, right. And I'm like, yeah. I think it's righteous for us to have rage. I don't know that this way of moving with our rage is actually going to get us free. And that's always my concern. So Miriam Kaba has been a major teacher for me on abolition. And one of her guidelines is always like, how do we end the harm? And that's one of the things I feel. I'm like, if it worked, if we canceled people or called them out or whatever, and it just worked, and it was like, great. Mm-hmm. They just are no longer being a white supremacist. So let's keep doing that. I would be so down for it. But what I've seen much more often is people just move to another location. They get more defensive often. They sort of double down on their behavior or they disappear. And so then as a movement, we lose people that I don't think we can afford to lose, especially over things that could be addressed in process and held and transformed.
I wanted to step back just for a moment to kind of talk about the original essay that you wrote and the process of writing the book, because I thought it was really gutsy and also something people I feel like people do enough, which is you put this essay about abolition and cancel culture into the world and took a lot of heat for it. And instead of, you know, becoming defensive and angry, what you did is you took that feedback and it kind of got incorporated into a edited version of that essay that's in the book. What did that feel like when you got that initial reaction? Yeah. And secondly, since the book has come out, you know, there's been another wave of it. And that second wave to me almost seems more frustrating and familiar to me. Yeah. I made a documentary called The Problem with Apu, calling out this Simpsons character. Yes. Yeah. And so many people have said so many terrible things to me, some in person, mostly online, death threats, all these terrible things. Yeah. And you realize after, they have not seen the film.
Yeah, they didn't see
it. And they don't actually know what it is they're upset about. We can't even talk.
Yeah.
There is no conversation here. And there's an added irony to what you're actually writing about. Like, this is the problem. We cannot engage like this. So I just want to know your feelings both
at the time,
before and after, in terms of people's reactions and how you've felt about those things.
Yeah, I appreciate the questions. You know, I will say, like, I don't know that this piece would have ever come to be if I hadn't been away on sabbatical. And I kind of came back, you know, like I'd been off the internet, I'd been sort of disconnected from everyone and, you know, just trying to process the pandemic limitations in my own like little studio apartment in Hawaii that I was living in at that moment. And then I came back and I was like, what the hell is going on? Like, the community is just, everyone's, you know, attacking each other. As a facilitator and a mediator, which is how I've spent most of my adult life, I don't have strong public opinions necessarily. Like the goal is to sort of hold a neutrality so that people can trust me. Like when I show up in a room that people are like, okay, she's on our side. Basically, she wants to see us win. And then they're the ones who debate. They're the ones who hold a difference. And I just support that. So it was a real risk that I took putting the piece out that I was aware I was taking. But it definitely was a deep feeling to have it come back. You know, I was like, okay, I have enough likability cachet that I think I can take this risk. And then when it comes back, I'm like, oh! You know, the defensiveness did happen, but it happened privately where it was just like, oh, well, you clearly have not read the entire piece. Clearly you don't know my heart. And like, you don't know, you know, all I'm saying is I love you. I love you all so much. And I want to see you feel loved and feel belonging. And so I went through that. And then it took really close, good friends sitting with me and being like, here's what's happening. Here's what you missed. Here's where you could be listening deeper. And I was so grateful to, I am grateful that I have a bunch of people in my life who are not blinded by any visibility stuff. You know, they're just like, Adrian, girl, I've been knowing you. Mm-hmm. Your intentions are great. Your impact was not for this group of people. And the thing that also helped was like, of the feedback I got, 80% of it was still really positive. So the majority of people were reaching out to me like, this is happening in my organization. It's happening in my sector. It's happening over here. Thank you for naming it. Thank you for that. And then I was still getting the strong, like, but what about survivors? Why are you using these metaphors? Like, it was very specific feedback that I could parse out and I could address. And I had to reckon with, like, I've always believed this for everyone that I deeply respect, that I'm like, if you are not disrupting the waters, you're not having an impact. If everyone just agrees with everything you say, you're a Hallmark card or something. You know, you're not necessarily a revolutionary thinker or any of those things. So then I had to sit with like, oh, this is what it feels like to push an edge that feels important to push and feel the edge push back. When I put the book out, then I was prepared because I was like, I know there's people who will read the book. And I know there's a lot of people who won't on general principle, like just like, I already dealt with this and now she's just putting it out in a book form. And I feel okay with that because similar to my other books, especially Emergent Strategy, the goal was not so much to invite people into further conversation with me. The goal of the book is to create a tool that people can sit down with each other and they can read it and they can talk amongst themselves in their community, in their groups, in their organizations to just be like, well, how do we feel about this? I'm like, you might disagree with it, but at least then you're having an intentional conversation about how do we feel about calling out and cancellation and discernment and abolition and loving each other up and transformative justice. I'm like, we need to be having those conversations at this moment in history.
You talk like you have no ego, and that scares me.
No. I mean, I do, but it plays out in other places, right? So, like, my ego is, like, on my Instagram feed, I'll post a selfie and be like, look, I feel pretty. Do you know what I'm saying? I'm like, cool. Like, I can get my likes there. But when it comes to this work, I definitely feel like if my ego is too involved, I'm not going to be able to say what needs to be said here. The thing that helped is the critics who initially engaged me, who I was in relationship with, the book was run back by them, right? They got to see it. They had a chance to engage it. I didn't publish something else without coming back. And I was like, okay, these are the metaphors that I need to remove. They're gone. And now I've replaced them with metaphors from nature that actually do feel more powerful to me. Mushrooms and feeding frenzy piranhas. I'm like, that actually does work. And it's not something the right has fucked with, you know, because that was the other part is people were like, Trump uses this language. And I was like, I would never use the language that he uses, but I don't pay any attention to him. So I'm like, I don't know that because I don't my life is not in any relationship to his, right? My thinking. I will say I'm getting a huge amount of feedback. And again, it's quiet DMs and private messages and emails from people who are like, I had a critique of the initial essay. I read the book. You got it. Wow. Right. Yeah. And so that helps because people are like, I didn't expect it. I'm really surprised. And so I'm seeing more, and I've been seeing, like, even in the past month, a lot more posts about the book are starting to happen. Whereas when it initially came out, I think people were a little like, I don't know. I don't know. I'm not going to be the first to step out. So I'm leaning into it. I'm waiting to hear and open to, like, if people are like, there's some other major thing you missed, because I'm going to mm-hmm. keep learning. You know, mm-hmm. I'm like, when we're all free, then I'll stop learning. Right? We're not there yet. So I'm going to keep learning.
You know, you've talked a lot about abolition kind of being your driving philosophy. Can you define abolition for yourself and what that looks like and kind of how it impacts everything?
Yeah, the earliest form of abolition that I ever learned about was the abolitionists that were working at the time of active enslavement in this country. So it's people who are like, I want to end enslavement and I'm willing to hide people in my home or secret them away in my cabin, or, you know, like, I will work in every way, both through policy and through my own personal practices, to end the institution of slavery. But as we know, the institution of slavery didn't actually end, it transformed. So those same systems that were used to hold people and to find people, to catch people, they transformed into our modern prison industrial complex. And I would argue spread in so many ways, so that so many of us have the police in our heads, in our hearts. The Karen memes and all of that is really people who are just like, they walk around policing all the time. They're constantly looking for people that need correcting, that need to be taught the way to behave, which is a fundamentally white supremacist worldview, at least in this country. So white supremacist way to move through the world is, you're wrong, you're lesser, I must correct you. And if I cannot correct you, if I can't make you heal to my wishes, then I will make sure you're captured. So I will call the police to come get you. If that's what non-liberation looks like, then, and my work is liberation. You know, I'm like, I don't want slavery of my body or anyone else's body. And I don't want it, slavery of my mind. And I don't want policing. I don't want to be engaging constantly in the act of correction as if there's something right that I know and that others don't know. So I'm constantly looking for, like, where is policing? Where is that entrapment happening in my mind and my heart? For me, abolition is the work to completely end policing in prisons, for the sake of a real total liberation. And when I say liberation, what I mean is a species that is able to function interdependently with regards to the constant changes we're in, but with a sense of power. And I'm a scholar of Octavia Butler, so I'm like, we shape change. We are the co-creators of the world that we exist in. Right now, we have signed on to say okay to prisons. And we fund the prisons with our taxes. So we are very actively supporting the prison system being in existence. To be an abolitionist in this time, to me, is to say, I'm going to redistribute my attention, my practice, and my funds towards liberation. I'm going to pull it out of the prison system. So if you say defunding the police, then I think there also needs to be a personal practice that goes along with that, that says, and I will also stop policing and I will stop imprisoning. And I think that's connected to, and I will stop canceling, right? I will stop putting people, particularly with social media. I'm like, when you post someone's name, a movement person's name, as a harm doer in the public sphere, you're also putting them in the eye of the state. It's not like the state is, like, not able to see our mm-hmm. Twitter feeds, right? Mm-hmm. We know that they infiltrate. We know they pay attention to everything. So I'm like, I don't know that it's an abolitionist thing to do those public post callouts.
So just, I want to sort of dig in a little bit to this, because I think I hear you saying, like, there's a difference between tweeting about a famous person who did a thing, whether that thing is illegal or just distasteful. You know, could be illegal, could be just like, why would you say that about that thing? Which is, you know. And the difference between, like, this is a person in my movement space calling that person out or canceling that person. There's a difference. Because I feel like, and so I just want to talk through how you see that specifically. We talked about Kanye earlier, yeah. And I sort of feel like Kanye could be anybody, but like, like the idea of like, and I think about Trump is sort of connected to this too. Like,
yeah.
Many people say these are two people who have mental health issues, mental health yes. challenges. We don't yes. know what they are. Or with Kanye, maybe we know what they are, but the idea being that like they are doing harm in the world and so yeah. don't concentrate on their mental health. I get that, although uh-huh, I feel like uh-huh. it's hard to talk about them without talking about that, but I get it. I get it yeah, as being yeah. ableist.
Yes.
But then there's the idea of like separate, so not talking about that, this person is doing harm in the world. Let's take away Trump now because that's, I feel like that's an easier target.
Yeah.
But Kanye is like, you know, hugging Trump, MAGA hat, Harriet Tubman, like all sorts of things
going on there. Yes.
And I just feel like, I feel like me sort of like going, whoa, hey, no.
Right.
I'm not necessarily trying to cancel him. First right. of all, I don't know that we can cancel him in
That's
sort of
right.
a social media way,
because right.
he's going to still be doing fine, and he is still
That's
doing
right.
fine. You know,
That's right.
What is that? Am I policing yeah. in that moment, or am I just sort of like, I sort of always think about it, and to use a bad metaphor, I'm a stand-up comedian, we're known for our bad metaphors. I think about like baby with a knife. I don't know how this happened, but I need to get the knife away from the baby. I don't have time to explain to the baby. I just need to get the knife away from the baby, you know?
So before I answer this question, I think Hari fell off the call, and I wonder if we should...
Look at you facilitating. Wow. I just heard somebody drop off. They're not important to me.
And I didn't okay. see a return. So, let's
pause and you're doing the right thing.
I was just like, I have answers, but.
I don't care. I have a good question.
You're like, I'm still talking. Mr. Vice President, I'm speaking.
Yes. Exactly. or as we say all the time, I'm the host of the show now. To quote,
I'm the host now. How to speak to this? There's this concept that I've been playing with called attention liberation, where I'm like, how do we liberate our attention from things that frustrate us, from things that we actually have no power over, from things that we cannot change, and bring our attention to those things that we actually can impact and we can change. And one of my mentors was Grace Lee Boggs, who was an Asian American activist, part of the Black Power movement here in Detroit. And she talked about that, like, we have to take responsibility for each other. We have to transform ourselves to transform the world, and then we have to take responsibility for our communities. I think that it can feel more satisfying to sit on Twitter or sit on social media and rant against somebody who you cannot impact, mm-hmm. you have no power over, who is clearly doing something offensive to you, and say all the things about how offensive that is. I think in some ways it's more satisfying and it's easier to do that than to actually turn and look at people in your community who are struggling and suffering and causing offense, breaking boundaries, doing stuff that you would actually have to be responsible for. Mm. Like that, and that's what I want to do is I'm interested in the attention liberation. Mm. It's like, how do you bring your attention away from, you know, someone like a Kanye West who it's like, yes, there's the mental health issues. But so many people have mental health issues. You know, I think that yes. white supremacy is a mental illness completely, right? Mm-hmm. I feel that egregious patriarchy, toxic masculinity, those are mental illness. You know, that's, to me, a mental illness is any time we have fallen out of alignment with our species good, you know, our long-term survival, our interconnectivity, right? Something is awry. And so I think what it's ableist to be like, oh, that's this. And so we dismiss that person as someone who can change and who can grow. I know tons of people, including myself, who struggle with mental well-being, and because we're in community, we can still grow. And because we take responsibility for each other and ourselves, we can still grow. I think the reason we ended up with 45 as president is because of that rubbernecking, like can't look away from a crisis. We actually are finding pleasure in both the dumpster fire presence of someone like that, like just the, you know, we love looking at the crisis. And then I think we get a pleasure from punishing. So when someone steps up like that to be that kind of villain, then we get the pleasure of punishing them and constantly then reinforcing how good we are because look, I'm not like that. I'm mm-hmm. not like that person. And yeah. then I think that pleasure gets closer and closer to home with this kind of pattern of calling people out rather than calling people into that responsible relational work of either transformative justice processes or mediation or community accountability. I think this is a very particular phase of history that will pass. So we're in this very weird moment where it's like, ooh, like, I don't like, you know, what this person said on the news last night. I think they're a flip-flop or whatever. I'm going to just post a whole thing and go off about it. And yeah, it's super satisfying. And we think that we can touch them in some way. And maybe sometimes occasionally we do. But with people like who are famous and maybe have no analysis, yeah, and are not really up to some intentional thing in the world other than getting attention, we're just nourishing that part that wants attention. Good attention, bad attention, you know, it's attention to them. And maybe we're hurting their feelings. Maybe we're driving the dramatic cycles of their own lives. Some people get off that train and are like, you know what? This isn't good for my health. This isn't good for me. Or, you know, I saw, you know, Taylor Swift like turn the comments off on her social media or whatever. You know, people eventually are like, huh, like it's actually not worth it. Maybe you will recognize this is for a lot of people, you know, there's some people who set out like, I want to be famous, but and yes, that's their goal. But for many of us, we're just like, I want to do my job well. And then if it leads to fame, then all of a sudden there you are. You know, like, I think this is very hard for musicians and actors and people. It's like, the thing I'm called to do is make music. And that's the kind of job where everyone's opinion about it actually matters, yeah, in a certain, yes, way. Which doesn't mean you're prepared to be famous. It doesn't mean you're prepared to live your life in front of others. Our work is to figure out what we're going to do with our attention, which is precious, which is mighty, and which hopefully we still believe can change the world. Are we still in touch with that sense of hope? Like, not like, again, like a shallow sense of like hope, yes, we can, you know, but a real sense of like, we're not done as a species, even with climate crisis, even with, you know, this last 4 years, even with the crisis at the borders, even with the crisis of prisons. I'm not giving up on our species. I think we should fight, even if we are going out like dinosaurs. I think we fight till the last minute. Like, there's something beautiful about us. And I think hopelessness is the other side of that, where we're just like, fuck it. Mm-hmm. We cannot grow. We cannot be better than this. Let's just punish each other until we're done.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, yeah. What do you say? Attention liberation?
Attention liberation.
That's the
problem. Hi, Hari.
Hi.
Welcome back.
Hari, do you have any questions about anything she said over the last 5 minutes or so? Anything, any points you want to pull out to really
drill down? We missed you.
Yeah, I have a question. How much money can I get back from Spectrum?
Don't cancel Spectrum and be a part of policing the world, Hari.
Sorry, I missed the last 10 minutes through the internet. So what do you imagine the future looking like, where cancel culture does not exist, where we talk to each other in the ways you hope and you've described? What does that future look like?
I love this question, Hari, because I think what it looks like is much more attention has to be put on our own behaviors rather than what other people are doing wrong. We have to get into our own practices. And while you were gone, I was quoting Grace Lee Boggs, you know, this quote. She says we had to transform ourselves to transform the world. And I think that turning the attention inward, right? Not how is this person causing harm, but where does that live in me? Which is really terrifying. I think we're all really ashamed of the ways that white supremacy and racism and capitalism and patriarchy and all that stuff is like functioning in us. So I think that would be one piece, is that we would all be a little bit more self-reflective, self-accountable. My friend Alta Starr, who's a somatics teacher, poet, she recently said something about like, what does it look like when we're shameless? And not shameless like, bitch, I'll do anything, you know, but shameless like, I have turned and faced the harms that I have caused in my life. I have traced them back to the source of why, and I can speak about them without shame, that I know that I'm not above causing harm. And I know I'm not a perfect saint of a person or whatever. Like, I'm just like anyone else. I do these things. I think when we see harm show up, it's like when you see one dolphin jump out of the water and it's like, oh, there's 40 under the water. It's like when we see harm show up, it's like there's so much under that water. There's so much more happening there. Can we get curious about what's under the surface and what causes that? There's this group called Generation 5 that talked about ending child sexual abuse. And they talked about a vision for, like, it would take 5 generations to end child sexual abuse. And a huge portion of that would be actually being able to notice how ubiquitous it is in the culture. And I think that's the truth with almost all the harms we're talking about, right? Is the reason that people are crossing sexual boundaries and sexually assaulting and all of that is because we live in a culture that has affirmed and trained us to be in sexually dysfunctional and sexually harmful dynamics with each other. It's going to take generations of examining that and making sure we're not practicing that, even in our most intimate relationships. And, you know, I do enough like love coaching and relationship coaching and stuff. I mean, I'm a pleasure activist. And a lot of what I've been finding is, first of all, people in movement are not necessarily having great sex and not necessarily having like great conversations around sex. And now everyone's so scared because it's like, and I'm like, yeah, there's ways, but it takes examination. It takes intimacy to be able to notice with the, again, to let the shame move out of the, you know, the ego and the shame get out of the way. So you can be like, shit, I crossed your boundary. I'm so sorry. How do I not do that again? How do we reconnect? So all of that feels connected to the future. I think in the future, we're able to have really good conversations about when harm happens, how do we recover from it? We take less time. You know, it's okay if like someone says you fucked up, it takes you much less time to then be like, oh, my bad. Like you just believe them. Like, I'm sorry, I had an impact on you. Let me take accountability for it. And here's what I'm going to do to not do it again. I think an Octavia Butlerian way of imagining the future is like, these problems may not continue, but new problems will emerge. And right. What we want to do is be like together, curiously addressing new problems, right? I've never been a big fan of like the idea of heaven necessarily. Like I don't want to sit on a cloud and just have no problems. I like problems. I like having stuff to be in difference with people about. I think that's where the friction of aliveness comes into play. So that, you know, the future I want is one in which I look at my nibblings and I'm like, I want y'all to have less fear of being honest and apologizing and less fear of each other, less fear that you'll say the wrong thing or do the wrong thing and you'll no longer have belonging.
You mentioned pleasure activism. You wrote a book on pleasure activism. So in closing, I wanted to know, first of all, for the listeners, can you define pleasure activism? And secondly, how does the author of Pleasure Activism celebrate Valentine's Day?
Pleasure activism is all of the things that we do to reclaim our right to pleasure from the myths and lies and distortions of oppression. So I really feel that we're all wired for pleasure, but then there's all these things about who looks like they are allowed to have pleasure, who has the money for pleasure, who has the whiteness or the maleness or whatever else. And those people deserve pleasure and the rest of us are just supposed to serve their pleasure and like serve their lives. And it's bullshit. And so it's really looking at how do we understand it from the inside out that we all deserve to feel pleasure. A big part of this is that pleasure does not mean sex dungeon. Unless that is your pleasure, right? Because a lot of times people look at me, they're like, oh God, pleasure. And I'm like, no, you are repressed. Pleasure just means happiness, contentment, joy, satisfaction. So a lot of what I ask people is, are you satisfiable? Are you satisfied? Would you know if you were satisfied? And at an individual and a collective level. So I think that it really helps to be in a regular practice of excellent orgasms because you know you're satisfied. And so then when we come together in a community of people who know what satisfaction is, I think it changes the way we're able to fight for what we want in the world. And we stop settling for false solutions. And we're like, that's not satisfying. I don't want a fake orgasm of a climate policy. I want something that is actually going to like change the future, right? The other piece is looking at the things that give us pleasure and making sure they actually align with the future that we want. Me Too culture, you know, I've been looking at, okay, what's the opposite of having those boundaries crossed? How do we have a luscious, abundant consent culture? Those kind of things are all part of pleasure activism. And Valentine's Day, it's funny, for years I was like, I don't celebrate Valentine's Day. Now I think it's something where I feel a lot of attention to like who in my life is in romantic relationships, who's not. And how do I make sure that everyone is really clear about how much I'm in love with them? I'm in love with a lot of people, but I'm also in partnership with someone who is hyper romantic Libra. So I expect that my Valentines will be receiving some kind of gift from this beloved person, and, you know, blushing and demurring and then being like, okay, well, when are we having sex? So like, those are my plans. What about y'all? Do you do Valentine's Day?
I'm supposed to be a hyper romantic Libra.
It's still in there. It's in there. It might be your chart is a little off by some other things. Channing Nichols will help you figure it out.
Oh, I've been told I have to figure it out. So
His chart's been off since I've known him. So
I just know that I'm not supposed to just buy chocolate and flowers. So I got to do some thinking.
Oh yeah.
No, you have to think about what is the person you love most love, and how can you contribute to them experiencing that? Like, for me, my partner knows, I'm like, I would rather be in a bath than most places in the world. So if there's anything ever off with me, if I'm upset, if the dishes weren't done, whatever else, I'm like, just run me a bath. We're good. You run me a bath and we are good, right? I'm like, now you take me to a sports event, that's your favorite thing, I'm less good, right? But I'm like, for me, I have to be like, oh, I have to think about how do I make a sports event type thing happen.
I'm like, okay.
Yeah, love advice. A whole different podcast.
Yes, we'll have you back for that. I've been with my partner since 2003, and we've been married I should know this off the top of my head, but
it's a pandemic.
Long time. We've been married 12 years this year. So,
oh wow.
Yeah, so. Yeah, with three kids, nine and under. So Valentine's
Amazing.
Day.
Amazing. You're like, we did Valentine's Day. Yeah, we did a lot of. We know we love each other. Yeah, it's
but
done.
No, she's always just like, I don't care about that day, but there has to, basically, like, that day doesn't mean anything to me, but we can't figure out a time in that area to sort of go to spend time together. Right. So she allows me not to put it all in the day, but like, we need to commemorate that somehow, but don't get caught up on the day, because she knows I get freaked out if I'm like,
this day must be perfect. I mean, I think that's one of the fucking, like, the worst parts of capitalism is that it's like, romance is on this day. Your birth gets celebrated on this day. Black people get celebrated this month. This is the only time for this. And it's just like, no, you know, like, we have a romantic life. We love each other every day. It shows up in the very mundane things, you know, like, my partner doesn't like garlic that much. And like, I would eat an entire bulb, whatever it is, you know, like, I'm just like, I want to like roast it and spread it on everything and whatever. And so like, my most loving act yesterday was I made a soup, and I made it with very little garlic.
I love that it's very little, not none.
No, not none, because I'm not going to fuck the soup up, but I am going to meet her where she's at. Right? So, you know, it's love.
Adrian, you're the absolute best. Thank you so much for being on our podcast.
Y'all.
It's really
a pleasure.
I really
appreciate you. And, thank you so much for doing what you're doing. I hope you understand. I think politically reactive is also an act of pleasure activism, like bringing comedy, bringing laughter into the very serious work that we need to attend to and the very serious lessons we need to learn. To me, that is a huge part of what pleasure activism is. So thank you for what y'all do. And tell Jocelyn you did okay.
He did okay. He did okay.
Adrian Marie Brown is writer in residence at the Emergent Strategy Ideation Institute.
Her latest book is We Will Not Cancel Us and Other Dreams of Transformative Justice. She's also co-host of two podcasts, How to Survive the End of the World and Octavia's Parables.
She also had some recommendations for politically reactive listeners, including Following the Movement for Black Lives at m4bl.org. That's m4bl.org. They're going to be coming out with a State of Black America report at the same time Joe Biden gives his first State of the Union address.
She also recommended The Frontline, a new organization fighting to defeat white nationalism and advance a people's agenda. They've created a set of original art postcards so that you tell the Biden-Harris administration what exactly you want with the hashtag, #ThePeopleDemand. Find them at thefrontline.org. That's it for this week. Thanks to Adrian Marie Brown and Adam Gentleson.
We always want to hear what you think about the conversations we're having on Politically Reactive.
So leave us a voicemail at 917-477-6525.
That's 917-477-6525.
And keep your comments and questions coming on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram with the hashtag Politically Reactive.
and rate and review the show wherever you get your podcasts. It does help spread the word and help people discover the show. And I want them to discover the show because it's a very good show and we both have children, and the more people that listen, the more they get to eat.
You know, I tend to feed my kids whether or not people listen to the podcast, but that's just me. So as you heard in the show, there's lots of ways to reach out and help people this week. Adrienne Marie Brown told you about thefrontline.org, also the Movement for Black Lives. That's M4BL.org. At the top of the show, we talked about the protests in India, the farmers protest, hashtag farmers protest, hashtag stand with farmers. You can go to farmersprotest.carrd.co, farmerprotest.carrd.co.
Also, come out and I have Netflix specials which you should watch. And also, why don't you go to our websites and sign up for our email list? Because one day, we're going to travel again, and you're going to want to see us.
Politically Reactive is a production of Topic Studios and Warner Media Podcast Network. Executive producers are Maria Zuckerman and Christy Gressman.
And me, Jesus Hari Kundabolu Christ.
And me, W. Kamau John the Baptist Bell.
The show is produced by Matt Martin, Malachi Seeger Sakir, and Kelly Rafferty. Will Stanton engineers and mixes the show.
And thanks as always to Brontez Purnell for providing music for the show. Thanks for listening to Politically Reactive. Hey, do you have any idea who John the Baptist is?
He's either a wrestler or was in the Bible.
Boy. Whew. I'm done.
No, I believe his catchphrase was, "Woo!"
That's him. That's the guy. That's the guy. That's the guy. You nailed it. I think his big finisher was called the Decapitator.